Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. For years, Turkey has been a key linchpin ally of the United States, both in the Cold War and the Middle East. And yet today, as a byproduct of the civil war in Syria, Turkish-American relations are at low ebb. And Turkish-Russian relations, historically a distrustful relationship, has never been closer. This despite the Turkish shooting down of a Russian military jet in 2015 and the assassination of the Russian ambassador to Turkey last year. My guest today says it's a result of a long populist regime of President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. Mahir Zeynalov is a Turkish journalist now living in the United States. He first started his professional career with the Los Angeles Times. He later joined Today's Zaman and worked there until the Turkish government shut down the newspaper in 2016. He's currently writing columns for Al Arabiya and regularly contributing to the Huffington Post. He's the first journalist in Turkey asked by Erdogan to be imprisoned, and he's also the first journalist to be deported from Turkey back in early 2014. He rose to international prominence for documenting the massive crackdown on Turkish journalists and is best known for reporting on the post-coup purge in Turkey that took place last year. He'll be speaking tonight on the post-coup Turkey this evening at 6:30 at the Raindrop Turkish House, and he joins us today on Studio Tulsa. Mahir Zeynalov, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
You were actually deported from Turkey almost 3 years ago, but certainly in the wake of this earlier last year, the coup in Turkey, you're seeing a number round of deportations and also a great number of people being detained and really a purge in Turkey. Can you talk about the circumstances of your being deported? You were the first journalist to be deported by the Erdogan government.
Right.
What were the circumstances behind it?
Well, actually, I wrote about an embarrassing corruption scandal that targeted President Erdogan. He was prime minister back then, and people in his inner circle. It was back in December 2013, and the Turkish pro-government media launched this huge smear campaign against me. And on that day, President Erdogan pressed charges against me for inciting animosity and hatred among public, seeking up to 6 years in prison. In a month, I was called into police for questioning, and I was asked, you know, why I wrote the things I wrote, and then I, you know, defended myself that, you know, these are the, you know, falls under protections enshrined in our constitution, and also our treaties that Turkey is party to. And 5 days later, they stormed our house, the police, and then they came to our newspaper. I had to, you know, flee the newsroom from the back door. I went to the safe location for 3 days. I stayed there. I met with no one. There was no phone or laptops that they could trace me. One of my editors took my phone, and, you know, he was traveling around Istanbul, and the police were after him just, you know, to deflect attention from me. And I could stay there for 3 days. And our sole purpose was that, you know, we'll have a kind of like window of opportunity so that our lawyers would appeal the decision. Usually whenever they deport someone, they give 1 week or 2 weeks so that we have time to appeal. But the pressure was so tremendous that the police were after me everywhere. And I met with my wife in the middle of night, like 4 or 5 in the morning. Actually on February 7, 2014, almost exactly 3 years. And I went to the airport police. We surrendered there. They provisionally detained us and escorted us out of the country. That was 5 days after the police, you know, questioned me about, you know, why I wrote the things.
Now, what was the nature of the story? Was it just a routine corruption story, but it involved high figures in the government?
Right. Actually, I mean, that was it was part of a twin corruption investigations, perhaps the biggest in Turkish history. That included an Iranian Turkish national called Reza Zarrab, who is actually in prison in Manhattan at the moment, and he's facing charges of endangering the American national security interests. It's basically, there's an Iranian guy who is helping Iran to bypass U.S.-led sanctions on Iran since like 2011 until 2013. And Turkey helped this person to bypass U.S.-led sanctions.
So was it embarrassing on an international relations front?
But the most problematic was that President Erdogan's family and many of his ministers also profited from this because, you know, this guy wanted to get a Turkish citizenship for himself, for his family, and he bribed Turkish ministers for this. He bribed several other ministers so that he could you know, get through all this, you know, money through customs. And this is how it happened, because the Iranian banks could not use SWIFT code for international transactions of euro and dollar. So what they did, this person bought gold from Africa, particularly from Kenya, brought it to Turkey. And whenever Turkey purchased oil and gas from Iran, Turkey paid this person with lira. And that person bought this gold with lira and sent it to Dubai and to Iran. So that was a scheme to bypass these sanctions. And that's why this man is actually charged in the United States too, because it's also a violation of the U.S. laws too.
How unusual was the government's reaction to what you wrote compared to other journalists writing unflattering stories of the ruling party or unflattering stories or critical stories of Erdogan?
Right. I mean, at the moment, the situation is much more different. I mean, yes. The red lines are so closer now. I mean, if you cross them, you probably lose your job or your freedom. But at the time when I was deported, actually, we had somewhat independent media. We had a lot of critical journals who were writing, as you said, unflattering stories about Prime Minister Erdogan and people in his inner circle. But the problem with my story was that I also included someone in that story called Yasin Al-Qadi. He is a Saudi businessman who is known as financing radical groups in Syria and also Al-Qaeda. He was listed as a globally designated terrorist by the United States Treasury Department. When I included that person in the number of the suspects in that corruption investigation, and because mostly I was writing for the Western audience in English, that disturbed the Turkish government. That's why they tried to frame me as being someone who is trying to show the government, Turkish government, as if they are protecting Al-Qaeda financiers. So that's why, you know, President Erdogan was so unhappy. He called me a liar live on TV in the parliament. And that unleashed his fan base to attack me on Twitter, on Facebook. These were, you know, terrible, very traumatic, you know, periods for me, because just imagine that you are a simple correspondent in Turkey and there's a very popular leader targeting you live on TV, and he's so popular that he has a fan base who are basically, you know, assailing you online, and you're afraid that, you know, you'll just go out and they will just, you know, kick you in the street. And, you know, I hug goodbye every morning when I left home for work. And we had this thought, we never said it aloud, but we had the thought, me and my wife, that, you know, I may never be able to come back. And one morning I left house. It was a normal morning, and I couldn't come back, and I was forced to leave the country.
Yeah, that's a horrible story, and it's a story, unfortunately, that's been repeated more often here in the last year or so. Is your case a template for what's been happening since the coup in Turkey?
Well, it's actually a very small visible part of the iceberg. We had that crackdown on press freedom. It didn't start since the coup. I mean, it was going on for many years. We had, I think, like one or two journalists jailed like a decade ago. But things, you know, escalated in the past 5 years. And since I was deported, more than a dozen journalists, foreign journalists, were deported from Turkey too. And we had a kind of like slow motion coup in the past 3 years, but that significantly escalated since the failed coup attempt last summer. If you look at the numbers are staggering. We have 135,000 purged, dismissed, or sacked from their jobs, mostly public employees. And they were actually doomed to poverty because they cannot apply for a public job again. And they cannot leave the country because their passports were seized. They were ejected from the public housing. So they're kind of, you know, doomed to sell, you know, bagel in the street, basically. And we have nearly more than 50,000 people have been jailed since the coup attempt. And these are mostly university professors and doctors, teachers, you know, even soccer referees, members of the judiciary, you know, baklava sellers, you know, any type of persons, you know, were jailed in connection to the coup. On ludicrous charges, such as, you know, downloading a smartphone app or subscribing to a newspaper.
Now, I was reading one of your columns where you talk about this app that it's an old app.
Right.
Tell us this story. It's about a, what is it called, Telegram?
It's called a Bylock.
Bylock,
yeah. Well, this is an app developed, I think, in 2014, and it was in use like for only like 6 or 7 months. And because it was so strong encrypted app, the many people in Turkey who were aware that, you know, the government may tap their phones were using that. You know, there could be any type of person that be using it, because we know that there are like 200,000 people downloaded that and developed by a Turkish, web developer. So it was, on Google Play and also in applications.
It was
and
a widely available app.
Yeah, so, this is the story. Just imagine, Telegram is widely used by ISIS militants because it has an encrypted, it's an encrypted messaging app so that the government cannot tap and intercept what people are talking there. So Bylock is very similar to that. So because the Turkish government really wanted to crack down on dissidents and, jail everyone that they deem as non-loyalists. So they believe that they have to jail those people. I mean, they have to present evidence. And they presented Bylock as an evidence that this is a group of people who downloaded it because they wanted to evade, government interception. And these people were, communicating with each other secretly. So that means they are part of a secret group who are masterminds of the failed coup attempt last summer. So it's kind of like a connecting kind of evidence, connecting these people together. And more than 40,000 people actually were put in jail just because downloading this app.
Now, is it selectively enforced? Is it basically they're looking for opponents to the Erdogan regime or people who oppose the actions of the government and using that as, you have Bylock?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's very similar to Telegram. Just imagine the download Telegram and the United States authorities, come and, detain you because it's an app widely used by ISIS militants. And we know that 107 lawmakers, ruling party lawmakers, are also using that. and it's all in their reports.
Guilt by association.
Right. So, it's a selective justice, basically.
Yeah. My guest today is Mahir Zeynalov, a Turkish journalist who currently writes for Al Arabica and the Huffington Post. And he was the first journalist to be deported from Turkey 3 years ago. He was also one of the first journalists to be imprisoned by the Erdogan when he was still prime minister. But now that regime has imprisoned a tremendous number of people. We've talked a little bit about the abortive coup this summer. It seems so haphazard. It seemed like it was almost like a perfect opportunity to crack down. In your estimation, what was the foundation of the coup? Was it a real coup? Was it an attempt by the Erdogan government to make it look as if it were under threat? What's your best assessment?
Right. It would be a conspiracy theory to suggest that was a stage coup because we don't have any evidence to back it up. We cannot say that it was the coup that was controlled or somehow staged by Turkish authorities to use, as a tool to further crackdown on dissidents. But what we can say is that this does not really look like a coup that the Turkish military staged in the past. And look, our military is not bad at that. And we have been doing this, once in every decade. And Turkish military is very professional at doing this. There is no way that the very small faction within the military would stage such an amateurish coup attempt, which does not make sense at all. If you Google coup 101, you will see there the first control the message, control the narrative, right? It's not you have to first cut off the internet, and the internet was not cut off, and so that people could organize on social media and President Erdogan could call on his supporters to go on the streets live on TV, and the other ministers were also broadcast live, and they called on their supporters to go on the streets and confront the military. The second thing is arrest politicians, and no politician was arrested. And the third thing, in past military coup attempts, that we had four of them in the past 4 decades, the first thing they do, they stage coup when everyone is at home. It's like 5 or 4 in the morning. So you wake up and you see that, there's a military coup and they impose curfew. But the coup last summer was on Friday night prime time when people were out partying. So whenever you impose curfew, you cannot just force people to go inside. So it will be bloody. And why would you occupy a bridge, for God's sake? most of the deaths were in the bridge. And why would you bomb the Turkish parliament, the symbol of our national unity? It doesn't make sense at all. So for me, it sounds like the government knew about the impending coup. It was impossible that they didn't intercept all these extensive communications. It took extensive planning. And almost a month before the actual coup on July 15. So when you look at the military, if I was Erdogan, I would look at the military and see how can I undermine this coup, right? So what you do is you look at how, military coups are being staged. First of all, there's the junta, and that junta is kind of like a brain, a mastermind who are drafting plans of this coup. You are basically taking over government, taking over a country. So this junta makes sure that everyone is on board. You know, if I ask you to go and, you know, stage a protest outside the governor's house, the first thing you're going to ask is how many people are going to be there, right? I mean, it's not like you alone will go and unfurl a banner there. So this junta usually goes to other segments of the military and makes sure that they're on board. So I think this is what happened. Considering that Turkish military is a battleground between the pro-Russian group and the pro-Western, pro-NATO, pro-United States, you know, folks there, President Erdogan wrote a letter 2 weeks before the military coup to Vladimir Putin of Russia, apologized for shooting down their jet in northern Syria a year ago, secured a pro-Russian group within the military. And when that pro-Russian group within the Turkish military withdrew their support, it basically fell apart. They were kind of like betrayed. And because they, you know, didn't like these pro-Western, pro-NATO folks in the military, so they were just, you know, it just fell apart. And when we look at the crackdown in the military, we see that those people who are either posted to NATO, military envoys posted to NATO in Europe and United States, are being purged. And it was former, you know, U.S. Army Chief General Dunford who said that Turkish authorities are arresting our interlocutors. So it's very obvious that what happened on July 15 was not really actual coup that was initially planned. These plans were shelved, but something happened on July 15. We just saw that tanks were rolled in the streets and, you know, jets bombed our parliament and many people died. So Erdogan could have prevented this military coup, but if he prevented it, he had to purge it. And everyone would read it as, you know, Erdogan is just transforming the military, purging the military, right? So he allowed this coup to come into open so that he will have a tremendous popularity at home, tremendous international sympathy abroad, and it will give him actually a very good chance, in his own words, gift from God, to further crack down on dissidents. And he skillfully is exploiting these military coup just to do whatever he wants. He imposed emergency rule, which allows him to rule by decrees.
Now, you mentioned this whole role that Turkey plays with balancing Russian interests and the United States interests. A lot of people in the United States are now saying, you know, we consider Turkey a very close ally since the Cold War, really. And all of a sudden, that relationship is changing, and it seems to be changing very, very quickly, at least from a United States viewpoint. Is that relationship changing?
Well, the thing is, I mean, it's very ironic that, you know, Turkey shut down Russian jet a year ago and killed their ambassador in December, but relations are flourishing between Russia and Turkey. I mean, these are events, you know, it's a once in a century event, right? I mean, usually, you know, unleash, you know, world wars. But the thing here, why Turkish pro-government media and Erdogan and Turkish ministers kept bashing the United States was because it was a lame session for President Obama. He was outgoing president, and they really wanted to show to President Trump that they really don't like Obama. And, you know, President Erdogan was so euphoric about President Trump's victory, illustrated how bad relations were with the Obama administration. It's because, you know, Turkey asked the Obama administration to cease support for Syrian Kurdish militia, and the United States did not. And Turkey is expecting that the Trump administration will do. And also, there's a case about the extradition of the U.S.-based cleric, Gulen, which Turkey claims that is the mastermind of the military coup attempt, and Gulen denies these allegations. So basically, we can easily see that Turkey is jumping on the Russian bandwagon because, as I said, Turkey really believes that those groups who tried to stage a coup against Erdogan was those people who were blessed by the West and by NATO. And frankly, Turkey and Erdogan does not really feel that threat from Russia. I mean, Vladimir Putin does not lecture Erdogan about his human rights record and crackdown on the media. It's the countries in NATO or the United States who are telling Turkey not to go the way they do. So in that sense, when we look at how many times Erdogan and Putin met, it's like I think like six times they met and more than seven times they talk on the phone in the past 6 months, which is unprecedented. It just shows how much Turkey and Russia are getting closer. Now Iran, Turkey, and Russia are holding Syria peace talks, kind of sidelining the United States from these talks. And because Turkey is so frustrated about the Obama administration for not helping Turkey to oust Bashar al-Assad, the Syrian president, Turkey really believes that Russia is an actual player in Syria and can help Turkey to promote its own agenda and create a sphere of influence in northern Syria.
We've had a couple of guests talking about basically the last couple, you know, once the civil war became a stalemate, for all intents and purposes, the Obama administration just checked out. Is that sort of the source of the resentment from the Turkish government?
Yeah, I mean, the Turkish government and also Turkish people really wanted President Obama to strike targets, Syrian regime targets, back in 2013. And when the United States, you know, backed down from that threat after the red line was crossed, when the chemical weapons were used, you know, Turkey was so frustrated. Erdogan felt so betrayed. And from that on, Erdogan, you know, knew that, you know, he has to take things on his own hands. So he turned a blind eye when thousands of foreign fighters used Turkey as a territory to cross into Syria. And most of these radical groups, Erdogan believed, were fighting against Assad. And when they failed, those rebels failed, these radical groups joined ISIS. And also Turkey's border was so porous, and you know, all these equipments and arms went to ISIS, and Turkey benefited from ISIS oil trade too. So in a sense, it was the Obama administration's failure to walk their talk that led many countries in the region, including Turkey, to see that actually the United States is not even leaving from behind and left us alone all here. And it's not credible actor anymore. And we have Iran and Russia who are actually changing the realities on the ground. And now one of the Turkish ministers said just several weeks ago that, you know, it would be unrealistic to ask Assad to leave. That was Erdogan spent like 6 years of his, you know, 14 year of rule to make sure that Assad is gone. And now he's coming to terms that, you know, Assad is there to stay. And, you know, it's up to Turkey to go and do its own job. And they invaded northern Syria. They made sure that there's no autonomous Kurdish state out there in northern Syria. And they are now struggling to capture a key town called El Bab in northern Syria. Yeah. And they are working very closely with Russia and Iran to make sure that Turkey is establishing that sphere of influence in northern Syria.
Now, this move towards Russia, is this a temporary sort of partnership, or is this sort of a beginning of maybe a longer-term sort of relationship with Moscow? We've always thought of Turkey as always looking to the West, seeking EU membership, certainly a cornerstone of NATO. Is this a switch in focus for the Turkish government?
Like in the Middle East, when countries are autocratic, they are actually becoming more pro-Western, ironically. I mean, look at Egypt or Jordan, who are, you know, autocratic countries, but they are more pro-Western and pro-Israel. And when you look at, you know, Eastern Asian countries, if they are more pro-democratic, they are more pro-Western, pro-United States, like South Korea or the Philippines that was, or, you know, look at Myanmar, what's happening there. You know, the more democratic they become, the more pro-Western they become.
Sure.
So, but Turkey is a country that is really trying to reassert and redefine itself as a Western country or Eastern country. So there is that danger, you know, whenever Turkey is drifting away from democracy and human rights, they're also drifting away from West. There's that danger. Turkey has to be, you know, democratic to be able to stay in the Western orbit and close to Western countries. And, you know, for decades, Turkey was a very strong ally of the United States. It was the only Muslim member of NATO and helped, you know, the United States and the European Union in its, you know, plans in Afghanistan in fight against terrorism. And actually, President Trump and President Erdogan just talked last night and the United States pledged support for Turkey in its fight against ISIS. So there is that long pattern and history tradition of alliance between Turkey and the United States. You cannot basically throw away. But the thing is, I believe Erdogan believes that it was the Obama administration that gave a green light for the pro-NATO, pro-Western generals in the Turkish military to stage a coup. True or not, I don't know. That's what Erdogan believes. And he believes that Trump, and he actually said that, President Trump will not lecture him about the human rights record. So in a sense, perhaps under Trump presidency, there might be some kind of honeymoon between the United States and Turkey. But it may not take long because of some of the remarks of President Trump about Muslims and this, you know, Muslim ban, travel ban. So in a sense, when you look at the Erdogan's electorate, who mostly dislike Trump, so it cannot go that long that Erdogan and the Turkish ministers are looking so favorable to President Trump. And also, when you look at Turkish economy, we don't have natural resources. We don't have oil and gas. We cannot stay independent that so long. We're so linked to the West with $350 billion credit. Our economy is credit-driven, and we cannot have, like, autocracy because we really need those foreign investors to come and invest in our country. And this uncertainty and political turbulence is really scaring off investors and tourists, and we need this hot money to come into the country. It's important to have this economic stability because this is one of the factors underpinning Erdogan's presidency. He knows that he has to keep economy good. If it goes south, I think that will be the start of the process that people will start questioning his authority.
What are some of the things you're trying to relate to the people you're talking to here in Tulsa about your own experiences and sort of relationship to, as you're watching here in the United States, the relationship between governments and the press here in the United States, which seems to be far rockier than normal.
Right, exactly. I mean, it's very ironic that, you know, I was deported from Turkey. I came here and then there's, you know, a President Trump won. Things are replicating what happened in Turkey. And I'm thinking maybe I should move to Canada. And I really fear that, you know, somebody like President Trump or President Erdogan could be elected there too. When you look at this, you know, populist upsurge all around the world, look, if Marine Le Pen in France is elected next year, we'll have these, you know, five permanent members of the United Nations Security Council. It's Xi Jinping of China, Vladimir Putin of Russia, Theresa May of UK, Marine Le Pen of France, and Donald Trump of the United States. These are five people that will rule the world next year if Marine Le Pen is elected. So there is certainly this uptick in the populist surge all around the world, from the Philippines, from all these, you know, things going on with Brexit in UK and in France. And Turkey's role is very important here in keeping these refugees kind of a hostage in Turkey, because those Christian Democrats, social democratic governments in Europe really understand that if those refugees start going into Europe, it will fuel this xenophobic, racist, far-right parties to rise up and win elections, and they understand that. So that so-called dirty deal is there to stay, that European Union will bribe Turkey to keep these Syrian refugees there. And it's a big part of the discussion and debate in the United States too, because that immigration and also jobs and strong borders are all intertwined, that the people really feel that they're not being racist whenever they don't want, you know, Hispanics to be here or illegal immigrants to be here or undocumented, you know, to be politically correct. Because they really say that, okay, this is all about economy. It's not like, you know, we don't want these folks here, but they're coming here and stealing our jobs. But as a matter of fact is that in the past 15 years, the and this process, you know, happened, you know, two centuries ago during the Industrial Revolution too. That era, whenever you graduated from school and then you have the lifelong job has gone, you have to update your skills in every 5 years to catch up. And whenever you cannot, you are out of the job, basically. And because of the multiculturalism and globalization, there are many skilled workers that are coming from all around the world, and they are dreamers. They can find jobs here. So of course, corporations will prefer them. And also because of the cheap labor in Mexico, in China, in Bangladesh, in other countries, these jobs are being shipped back to these countries. So you see a very disadvantaged blue-collar white workers who find themselves, you know, out of the job. And now we have a president who promises to protect their jobs, protect the border. All the U.S. consumers is going to pay for all this that's happening, you know, raising the tariffs or making sure that these jobs are staying here and they're not being shipped back to other countries. All the U.S. consumers are going to pay that. You know, people really can relate to their life that, you know, okay, I can pay more. There could be more inflation, but as long as I have a job, it's fine. So you can get more votes if you actually create more jobs.
Well, Mahir, it's a pleasure to talk with you. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Deported Turkish journalist Mahir Zeynalov speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. He'll be speaking tonight about the post-coup Turkey and ties with the United States under the Trump administration this evening at 6:30 at the Raindrop Turkish House. That's located at 4444 West Houston Street in Broken Arrow. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.